Random House Audio presents The Return of Depression Economics and the Crisis of 2008 by Paul Krugman. Read for you by Don Leslie. Introduction. Most economists, to the extent that they think about the subject at all, regard the Great Depression of the 1930s as a gratuitous, unnecessary tragedy. If only Herbert Hoover hadn't tried to balance the budget in the face of an economic slump. If only the Federal Reserve hadn't defended the gold standard at the expense of the domestic economy. If only officials had rushed cash to threaten banks and thus calmed the bank panic that developed in 1930 to 1931. Then the stock market crash of 1929 would have led only to a garden variety recession, soon forgotten. And since economists and policymakers have learned their lesson, no modern Treasury Secretary would echo Andrew Mellon's famous advice to liquidate labor, liquidate stocks, liquidate the farmers, liquidate real estate. Purge the rottenness out of the system. Nothing like the Great Depression can ever happen again. Or can it? In the late 1990s, a group of Asian economies that produced about a quarter of the world's output and were home to 2/3 of a billion people, experienced an economic slump that bore an eerie resemblance to the Great Depression. Like the Depression, the crisis struck out of a clear blue sky, with most pundits predicting a continuing boom even as the slump gathered momentum. As in the 1930s, the conventional economic medicine proved ineffective, perhaps even counterproductive. The fact that something like this could happen in the modern world should have sent chills up the spine of anyone with a sense of history. It certainly sent chills up my spine. The first edition of this book was written in response to the Asian crisis of the 1990s, where some saw the crisis as a specifically Asian phenomenon. I saw it as a troubling omen for all of us, a warning that the problems of depression economics have not disappeared in the modern world. Sad to say, I was right to be worried. As this new edition goes to press, much of the world, very much including the United States, is grappling with a financial and economic crisis that bears even more resemblance to the Great Depression than the Asian troubles of the 1990s. The kind of economic trouble that Asia experienced a decade ago, and that we're all experiencing now, is precisely the sort of thing we thought we had learned to prevent. In the bad old days, big, advanced economies with stable governments like Britain in the 1920s might have had no answer to prolonged periods of stagnation and deflation. But between John Maynard Keynes and Milton Friedman, we thought we knew enough to keep that from happening again. Smaller countries, like Austria in 1931, may once have been at the mercy of financial tides, unable to control their economic destiny. But nowadays, sophisticated bankers and government officials, not to mention the International Monetary Fund, are supposed to quickly orchestrate rescue packages that contain such crises before they spread. Governments like that of the United States in 1930 to 1931, may once have stood by helplessly as national banking systems collapsed. But in the modern world, deposit insurance and the readiness of the Federal Reserve to rush cash to threatened institutions are supposed to prevent such scenes. No sensible person thought that the age of economic anxiety was past, but whatever problems we might have in the future, we were sure that they would bear little resemblance to those of the 1920s and 1930s. But we should have realized a decade ago that our confidence was misplaced. Japan spent most of the 1990s in an economic trap that Keynes and his contemporaries found completely familiar. The smaller economies of Asia, by contrast, went from boom to calamity virtually overnight. And the story of their calamity reads as if it were taken straight out of a financial history of the 1930s. At the time, I thought of it this way. It was as if bacteria that used to cause deadly plagues, but had long been considered conquered by modern medicine, had reemerged in a form resistant to all the standard antibiotics. Here's what I wrote in the introduction to the first edition. So far, only a limited number of people have actually fallen prey to the newly incurable strains. But even those of us who have so far been lucky would be foolish not to seek new cures, new prophylactic regimens, whatever it takes, lest we turn out to be the next victims. Well, we were foolish, and now the plague is upon us. Much of this new edition is devoted to the Asian crisis of the 1990s, which turns out to have been a sort of rehearsal for the global crisis now in progress. But I've added a lot of new material as well, in an effort to explain how the United States found itself looking like Japan a decade earlier, how Iceland found itself looking like Thailand, and how the original crisis countries of the 1990s have, to their horror, found themselves once again at the edge of the abyss. About this book, let me admit at the outset that this book is, at bottom, an analytical tract. It is not so much about what happened as why it happened. The important things to understand, I believe, are how this catastrophe can have happened, how the victims can recover, and how we can prevent it from happening again. This means that the ultimate objective is, as they say in business schools, to develop the theory of the case, to figure out how to think about this stuff. But I have tried to avoid making this a dry theoretical exposition. There are no equations, no inscrutable diagrams, and, I hope, no impenetrable jargon. As an economist in good standing, I am quite capable of writing things nobody can read. Indeed, unreadable writing, my own and others, played a key role in helping me arrive at the views presented here. But what the world needs now is informed action. And to get that kind of action, ideas must be presented in a way that is accessible to concerned people at large, not just those with economics PhDs. Anyway, the equations and diagrams of formal economics are, more often than not, no more than a scaffolding used to help construct an intellectual edifice. Once that edifice has been built to a certain point, the scaffolding can be stripped away, leaving only plain English behind. It also turns out that although the ultimate goal here is analytical, much of the writing involves narrative. Partly this is because the storyline, the sequence in which events happened, is often an important clue to what theory of the case makes sense. For example, any fundamentalist view of economic crisis, that is, a view that economies only get the punishment they deserve, must come to grips with the peculiar coincidence that so many seemingly disparate economies hit the wall in the space of a few months. But I am also aware that the storyline provides a necessary context for any attempts at explanation, and that most people have not spent the last 18 months obsessively following the unfolding drama. Not everyone recalls what Prime Minister Mahathir said in Kuala Lumpur in August 1997. And relates it to what Donald Tsang ended up doing in Hong Kong a year later. Well, this book will refresh your memory. A note about intellectual style. One temptation that often afflicts writers on economics, especially when the subject is so grave, is the tendency to become excessively dignified. Not that the events we are concerned with aren't important, in some cases matters of life and death. Too often, though, pundits imagine that because the subject is serious, it must be approached solemnly, that because these are big issues, they must be addressed with big words, no informality or levity allowed. As it turns out, however, to make sense of new and strange phenomena, one must be prepared to play with ideas. And I use the word play advisedly. Dignified people, without a whimsical streak, almost never offer fresh insights, in economics or anywhere else. Suppose I tell you that Japan is suffering from fundamental maladjustment because its state-mediated growth model leads to structural rigidity. Well, guess what? I haven't said anything at all, At best, I have conveyed a sense that the problems are very difficult and there are no easy answers. A sense that may...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?